So we are reading today from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. First, let me say it's always a great honor for me to be allowed to sit on this seat where my Guru Maharaj, Srila Sridhar Swami, so many times he was lecturing here in this temple which is so full of memories of him. I'm always very happy and pleased to visit. So we're reading from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. The year is 1972, and Prabhupada is, it's in January actually, 1972. So Prabhupada is in Jaipur. While preaching in Jaipur, Srila Prabhupada was simultaneously reflecting on and, through letters to his disciples, acting on matters in many other parts of the world. Although he participated fully, giving two lectures a day, and although he constantly met and interacted with guests, friends, and devotees, he was also absorbed in thoughts excuse me, of other places and concerns. He was conducting his movement on many fronts. Wherever he happened to be at present was his camp, just as a general makes camps in various places while conducting many battles in the overall effort of a war. His preaching in Jaipur, therefore, was only a small fraction of the scope of his worldwide mission. From Jaipur, Prabhupada wrote his disciples in Calcutta, urging them in their development of the Mayapur land. He wanted a grand opening ceremony for Lord Chaitanya's birthday in March. Unfortunately, the government was restricting foreigners from entering Nadia because of its proximity to Bangladesh. "Please try very hard to get those permits," Prabhupada urged his men in Calcutta, "as we must be all assembled there for Lord Chaitanya's appearance day." Repeatedly, Prabhupada mentioned his concern over the government's restricting his men. It's a letter from Prabhupada. "I do not think there will be difficulty if we just go there like the ordinary pilgrims and set up our camp there for kirtan continuously. Anyone will see we are only serious devotees of Lord Chaitanya and not Pakistani spies." So this was at, I believe, it was during the time of the partitioning of India, Pakistan and Bangladesh. So it was a very tense time. It has to be seen in that light. Prabhupada wrote ahead to his disciples in Nairobi, driving them onward with his blessings. continue to work very hard for His pleasure, and all of you will go back to home, back to Godhead. To the San Diego Temple President, Srila Prabhupada wrote, "I'm very pleased to hear from you that book sales are increasing very fast. I'm hearing such good news from all over the society, and this pleases me more than anything." And Prabhupada was often thinking of the land in Bombay. Sometimes he talked about it or mentioned it in a letter to his representatives there. The Bombay land purchase was still not finalized, and Prabhupada was particularly anxious that his disciples pay the money as agreed and move immediately onto the land. So, of course, I guess most of you are familiar with many of the details, the whole history of this particular place here, which is narrated in the Lilamrita. As a new devotee, I already read Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. But later on, I was as a translator for the Danish branch of the BBT. I actually got the service to translate this abbreviated version of the Lilamrita to Danish, and I had a very distinct memory of that time when I was working on the Danish translation of the Lilamrita. And what really came very strongly through to me was how the whole story of behind this particular temple, it was like a theme of the whole Lilamrita. I saw it. I got that very strong feeling. And even though I knew the outcome, but it was like a thriller for me. It was so exciting. I still have very fond memories of when I was working on that translation. Such a drama, the whole story of the behind this land. And as I say, it's a well known story, but still I think it's worth recapping the way that Srila Prabhupada, he actually already, before he came to the West, he was staying not far from here in the Scindia colony, which is, I don't know where it is, I've not been there, but I understand it's not so far from here, because Prabhupada he came to Bombay to try to persuade Mrs. Sumati Muraji to give him a free passage to USA. She'd already been contributing towards the printing of the first volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which he translated here in India before coming to the West. So he came to Bombay and spent time here, and some, as it is also described in the Lilamrita, finally he actually managed to, much to the surprise of the workers in the Scindia company, he was actually able to persuade this lady into giving him free passage. She was quite adamant. She didn't want him to go, and basically out of concern, because she felt that he was too old and there was not much prospect. She wanted him to stay in India and continue his translation of the Bhagavatam here. Anyway, during that time, Prabhupada, he would always also go for walks or have his business in the area. So he spotted this land, actually. And he was already at that time thinking, oh, this is a nice spot. It would be nice to have a temple here. So when he, years later, came back to Bombay, and he was, in the beginning, they were staying in one apartment in downtown Bombay in the Akash Ganga building, and setting up the first pandal in the Cross Maidan, which was a huge success. So during that period, he also started looking for a place where they could have a permanent temple, and somehow or another he found this place. He remembered still that he had already been looking at this plot, and he negotiated with Mr. Nair, and of course Mr. Nair was willing to sell, at least he pretended to be, and he offered even he offered the land for a good price, and Prabhupada he agreed, and as it is mentioned here, Prabhupada was very eager to have the devotees move onto the land, because Prabhupada knew that in India, unlike the West, the rule is that if you occupy the land, then practically you are as good as the owner of the land. To us Westerners, that seems like a strange law, but of course, for those who know the scene in India, it makes sense, because there are so many, you know, people who with no possessions, and they need a place to stay also. So wherever they are staying, manage to settle down, it's better just leave them there, because otherwise if you kick them out, then you just got another problem. What to do with all of these, you know, people who have no money, no way to even rent a flat or anything. So better to leave them there they are, and at least they have a place to live. So Prabhupada knew that, and therefore he was very eager to have his disciples move onto the land, which was, for them, they were all Westerners, most of them at least, I think, apart from Lokanath Swami. He joined just around that time, so he was also there, but most of them, they were spoiled Westerners, and you know, there was no, yes, there was some buildings here, the apartment buildings that was dismantled in order to build the heaven on earth project. So these buildings were there, but they were all, you know, there were all tenants living there. There were, yes, one flat was the devotees, they were able to use for Prabhupada, but otherwise there was no place for devotees to live. So they simply had to set up tents and huts, and that was how they were living in the beginning here. And for those devotees who were there around that time, they all can tell stories about the big austerity which it was in these early days to live here. And at one point, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he was among them, and he came to Prabhupada and he was complaining. He was saying, you know, we are Westerners, we cannot live like this. We need doorknobs and running water, you know. These were his words. And what was Prabhupada's answer? Don't you want to become purified? Prabhupada, it's not that Prabhupada purposely wanted to subject them to, you know, some kind of torture or something, but the need was there. As I just finished explaining, that Prabhupada knew that unless they moved onto the land and actually was living there, he had some suspicion, even though later on he said that Krishna covered him over, so he didn't understand that this Mr. Nair was a cheater. But he did have some suspicion that, you know, that he might have some ulterior motive, so he considered it important that that the devotees, they should settle in. And especially he knew that if he would establish a temple there with deity worship, practically his position would be very strong, because to move a temple to, you know, that's practically impossible in India. If there's a temple where worship is going on, you cannot move it out for any, even if the land is yours, still that is a strong almost I guess it's practically a law. So anyway, the need was there. So Prabhupada, he was insisting that his young disciples, who were not at all accustomed to India, what to speak of living in a hut in India, that they stay here and struggle with the rats and the dogs and what else, the disease, and so many problems, so many difficulties they had to face. But of course the benefit was that since it was difficult, it was a place of struggle, so Prabhupada, he also blessed the devotees who were here with his presence for extensive periods. I heard somebody say that Prabhupada, out of all of the centers in ISKCON, Prabhupada spent more time in Bombay and Juhu than in any other center of the world. So that was the benefit they had. They had a lot of association with Prabhupada in those days here. I'll read a little more. Tamal Krishna was Srila Prabhupada's governing body commission secretary for India. Some of the devotees said that actually Prabhupada was a GB secretary for India. Although he allowed his secretaries in other parts of the world to manage mostly on their own and to make their own decisions. In India, he would scrutinize even small matters and make most of the decisions himself. Still, he counted on Tamakrishna as his trusted assistant in important dealings. He would send Tamakrishna from one Indian center to another to help the local devotees with governmental, legal, organizational, and preaching problems. In Bombay, just prior to coming to Jaipur, Tamakrishna had asked Prabhupada's permission to take sannyas, the renounced order. Srila Prabhupada had awarded sannyas to only a few men, and he had specified their duties as traveling and preaching. Taking sannyas, therefore, not only meant giving up wife and family, but also renouncing managerial posts. However, after Prabhupada gave sannyas to my Guru Maharaj, Siddhar Swami, I was, I think, in 76 in Vrindavan. He told him to go and manage here. He was not allowed to travel and preach, so it was not a very hard and fast rule that, you know, that sannyasi cannot manage. Siddhar Swami, he wanted to travel and preach, but Prabhupada was always involving him in management somehow. I guess because he was a good manager. Managers, sannyasis can also manage. It's not against the principles. At the same time, as Prabhupada had set up his governing body commission, he had also initiated several sannyasis, purposefully not appointing any of them, even though they were some of his most able men, as GBC secretaries. This has changed a lot. Many of the GBCs are sannyasis. The grihasthas were to manage the temples and presidents as GBC secretaries. And the sannyasis were to travel and preach. Srila Prabhupada, therefore, had to carefully consider whether or not to give Tamakrishna sannyas and thus lose his GBC secretary for India. On principle, Srila Prabhupada liked the idea of giving Tamakrishna sannyas. If a young man was actually qualified to give up family life and to use his intelligence and energy in preaching Krishna consciousness, then Prabhupada was always ready to encourage it. The world was in dire need of Krishna consciousness, and even hundreds of sannyasis would still not be enough. On these grounds, how could he not appreciate the request of one of his leading disciples to take sannyas? But first, he would test Tamakrishna's determination. Tamakrishna was insistent. Seeing that Prabhupada would not make a commitment, Tamakrishna had adopted the tactic of presenting himself before Prabhupada early in the morning without saying a word. In Bombay, he had entered Prabhupada's room, led the Mangalarti before the deities, and then sat silently before Srila Prabhupada. Knowing the mind of his disciple, Prabhupada could understand that Tamakrishna was not only determined, but obstinate. After several days of tolerating Tamakrishna's silent, insistent presence every morning, Prabhupada had finally agreed to consider seriously the request. Prabhupada was also concerned with Madri Devi Dasi, Tamal Krishna's wife. She was an attractive, intelligent girl who had given her life to Krishna consciousness, and Tamal Krishna, by his own choice, had married her a year ago. Spiritually, Madri was Srila Prabhupada's daughter, and Prabhupada wanted to protect her from undue disturbance. Even as householders, Tamal Krishna and his wife had been renounced, traveling with Prabhupada throughout India, with little time or facility for private life as husband and wife. Tamal Krishna had been in Bombay when Shyamasundar had informed him that Prabhupada had mentioned in a letter to Brahmananda Swami in Africa that Tamal Krishna might take sannyas. Spurred on, he had left his wife in Bombay and joined Prabhupada in Jaipur. On leaving, however, Tamal Krishna had asked Madri for his personal copies of the first three volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam signed by Srila Prabhupada. Madri had become suspicious. She had asked why he wanted them. "I just want to read them," Tamal Krishna had answered. But she had suspected the worst. "No, you're not coming back." But assuring her that he would definitely be returning, he had left for Jaipur. Once with Srila Prabhupada, Tamal Krishna again resumed his silent insistence. Whenever there would be an open meeting in Prabhupada's room, the DBC leaders would usually sit in a privileged position near Prabhupada so as to best receive direct instruction. Tamal Krishna, however, would simply sit outside the door. The first time he did this, Prabhupada looked up and said, "Tamal Krishna, you're sitting outside. That's very nice." And the other devotees took it that Prabhupada was praising his disciple's humility. When on one occasion Prabhupada addressed Tamal Krishna as Tamal Krishna Maharaj, the devotees were startled. The women devotees in Jaipur, being close friends with Madri, became angry at what they took to be Tamal Krishna's duplicity. Although Prabhupada had not given permission, Tamal Krishna went ahead with his plans, even to the point of preparing his sannyas danda and dyeing his clothes. The women were outraged. Madhi was not even there to represent herself. Altogether, the women went to see Srila Prabhupada, who patiently and sympathetically heard their presentation. Then Prabhupada called for Tamal Krishna and said, "Your wife is my daughter, my disciple, and I have to think for her also. So I do not know how I can do this, because she will be in great difficulty." Tamal Krishna argued, but Prabhupada pacified him and asked him to be patient. The sannyas issue had become a topic of controversy among the devotees in Jaipur. The men were rooting for sannyas, and the women were opposed. Prabhupada, however, remained grave. Throughout the week-long festival, large crowds continued to come for Prabhupada's morning and evening lectures. Prabhupada would chant prayers from Brahma Samhita and then lecture in Hindi. Not only did the citizens of Jaipur honor Prabhupada, but they honored his disciples also. Here, more than in most other Indian cities, the devotees were treated not as foreigners or outsiders, but as sadhus. This whole city is made of devotees of Radha Govinda ji, Prabhupada commented. The police chief, who visited often, was cordial and respectful. As Prabhupada and his disciples went from place to place in Jaipur during the day, policemen would salute them, halting traffic to let them pass. People invited Prabhupada to their homes and they treated him like a king. Prabhupada had also asked several women devotees to carefully observe the deity worship in Jaipur. They informed him they had observed that every night the deities were dressed in night clothes and that their clothes were also changed at two other times, in the morning and in the afternoon. The women told Prabhupada how a priest offered the deities scented oils on cotton-tipped sticks, which the priests would later offer, along with flower garlands from the deities to the incoming worshippers in exchange for fresh garlands. These devotional practices were standard, Prabhupada said, and could be introduced throughout ISKCON. Every evening Prabhupada spoke at the pandal, and often a respectable Jaipur citizen would introduce him. When the Queen of Jaipur introduced him one evening, she expressed her devotional sentiments for Prabhupada and his movement. After lecturing each evening, Prabhupada would stay for a slideshow of ISKCON's activities around the world. One night during the slideshow, Srila Prabhupada called Tamar Krishna over beside his Vyasa-san. "Taking sannyas now will be difficult," he said softly. "Your wife will suffer too much." He sat back a moment while Tamar Krishna took in what he had said. Then Tamar Krishna leaned forward and said with determination, "One way or the other, Srila Prabhupada, she's going to suffer. Either she'll suffer now when I take sannyas, or if I take sannyas later on, she will be just as unhappy. There will never be a time when she'll want me to. So since the feeling is going to be the same, it might as well come now. Free me. She'll get over it." Srila Prabhupada said no more, but he remained thoughtful. Later that night, after the pandal program, he called for his sannyas disciples, Subal, Madhudvisha, Gargamuni, and Devananda, and for his personal secretary, Shyamasundar. gathering them together around with Tamal Krishna, he said, Tamal Krishna wants to take sannyas. So what is your opinion? Should he take or not? Everyone agreed he should. Finally, Prabhupada consented. You will have to prepare things, he said. Things are prepared already, Tamal Krishna said. Then, said Prabhupada, tomorrow morning we must have this ceremony. The next morning, Prabhupada performed a special ceremony in the pandal, lighting the sacrificial fire and offering Tamal Krishna the sannyas danda. The women were angry with Tamal Krishna, but it was too late. After the ceremony, Prabhupada called Tamal Krishna Maharaj to his room. You have given up a very good wife and a high position. Therefore, I am giving you the title Goswami. Now you have to be in the same mood as the Goswamis, being able to preach all over the world and accept disciples. Suddenly, Prabhupada began to laugh. I've been testing you, he said, to see whether or not you were determined. So, what will you do? I thought I would go with my danda, said Tamal Krishna Goswami, and without anybody else, simply wander from city to city in India and preach about Krishna, without any vehicle or anything, just like Lord Chaitanya did. Very good, Prabhupada said. Tamal Krishna Maharaj offered obeisances and walked out. Scarcely an hour later, however, Prabhupada called him back. This is not a very good proposal, he said. If you want to do something, you should have some assistance and facilities at your disposal. Prabhupada then assigned a couple of brahmacharis to go with Tamal Krishna Maharaj for preaching. He also gave his new sannyasi his first assignment. Immediately after Jaipur, Prabhupada was planning to go to a festival in Nairobi, Africa. Yet in Ahmedabad, another program awaited him. You go on my behalf to Ahmedabad, said Prabhupada. That's one half page more, and we finish this section. Should I read that, and then we call it a day? At Tamal Krishna Goswami's sannyas initiation, Srila Prabhupada had given him the sannyas mantra, a verse that describes the surrender devotional attitude of the Vaishnava sannyasi. Vaishnava sannyasis emphasize engaging one's body, mind and words in ecstatic service to Krishna, as distinguished from the sannyas of the impersonalists who speculate on Brahman or sit alone in silent meditation. The Vaishnava sannyasi, by taking shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna, crosses the ocean of nations and brings others across with him. As Srila Prabhupada was demonstrating, a Vaishnava sannyasi should travel all over the world, working with all his might to reclaim the fallen souls on behalf of Lord Krishna. Vaishnava sannyas meant coming to places like Jaipur and preaching. It meant worshipping Govindaji in the temple, and it meant sending Radha Govinda to be worshipped by the devotees in New York City. As it factually happened, that Radha Govinda, the deities that were worshipped during the Pandal program, are now the Radha Govinda worshipped in New York temple. I heard just now that they are moving from Brooklyn, actually. Temple in New York is moving. That's another story. It meant allowing women as an equal opportunity to become pure devotees in Krishna consciousness. And it meant separating a man from his wife for the higher purpose of sannyas. Srila Prabhupada, although beyond the Varnashrama designation of sannyas, was nevertheless the best sannyasi and the creator of many other sannyasis whom he instructed to follow in his footsteps. He said his sannyasis should do even more than he, make more followers, publish more books, and establish more ISKCON centers. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.